Donald Epps versus Commonwealth, Mr. Smallwood and Ms. Martin. These two cases raise the identical issue, although I understand at Epps there is also a sufficiency issue. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Can we merge those for purposes of the argument?
Certainly, as long as the Attorney General does not.
As far as the merits of the substantive claim, I think they're exactly the same, but there are some procedural differences in the two cases that I would want to point out to the court.
All right, but do we need to hear these cases individually? You may begin.
May it please the court, I am Lee Smallwood. I do represent Mr. Davis and Mr. Epps, and certainly I think the assignment of error is the same as to the first assignment in Mr. Epps and the only assignment in Mr. Davis. As Ms. Martin indicates, the difference in the two of them is that I discovered the issue that existed with Mr. Epps before a sentencing order had been entered, and got the judge to make a ruling. And so he's in a bit different posture than Mr. Davis, where I only discovered these facts also applied to him when I was preparing an Anders petition and searching the record for error and found it. So as a result, Mr. Davis, we've alleged that this is a jurisdictional issue. The court lacks subject matter jurisdiction in both of these cases, and as a result, Mr. Davis is able to.
Why do you say this is subject matter jurisdiction?
Well, that's a really good question, and I would say Hansen v. Smith is a case that I looked at when I was considering these issues, and I think that the facts are laid out in that case in a way that confused me initially. So it's a situation where the Attorney General bringing it up certainly, I think, puts me in a bit of a tough spot. I would say that because I think that Haywood and Simmons contemplate this is a jurisdictional issue. Of course, they were decided under a different Virginia constitution than the one that existed at the time of Hansen v. Smith, and we're on another constitution now. The breaks being in 1902, there was a constitution of Virginia that was ratified, and then again in 1971.
Code Section 17.1-513 provides that all circuit courts of the Commonwealth have original jurisdiction of all indictments for felonies. So it would seem to me, this being a felony, the circuit court had subject matter jurisdiction.
I think certainly we'd have to argue that is not the case, and we'd have to essentially
Can you waive indictment?
You can waive indictment.
Can you waive subject matter jurisdiction?
You cannot waive subject matter jurisdiction.
Well, isn't that kind of an impediment to your argument?
Well, I've been thinking long about that, and I think what I would suggest is that subject matter jurisdiction, as outlined in Hansen v. Smith and the precedent it cites, is suggested that essentially it's a matter that's constitutional in nature. The Constitution is what lays out these requirements, like the waiver of a jury by the Commonwealth, for instance, because that is something that has a constitutional dimension in Virginia, and we'd contend that when we went from the 1902 Constitution to the 1971 Constitution, that the Due Process Clause and the movement of the Due Process Clause from the second paragraph to the first paragraph of Article 1, Section 8, though it doesn't say anything about indictment, would encompass subjects such as indictment. And I think that's the only way, candidly, that we get to this being jurisdictional, given Hansen v. Smith, other than to say the slaughterhouse cases were wrongly decided, as was Hurtado v. California, and the U.S. Constitution has a indictment. But I guess the question that I'm addressing is constitutional protections can be waived. So I can envision, if there's a requirement for indictment, that you could still have a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent affirmative waiver number of that indictment and not run afoul of subject matter jurisdiction. But you would have to have either a knowing, voluntary, intelligent, and affirmative indictment, a waiver of the indictment, or an indictment itself. So that's how I think you can waive indictment, but yet this is not an issue of subject matter jurisdiction, which of course cannot be waived, if that makes sense. So essentially that's, I think, where things are with Mr. Davis and the issue that exists in terms of the circuit court not being able to rule on the issue. Mr. Epps is, as I indicated, in a different position because the circuit court did get to rule on that issue and made its ruling, and the record is clearly preserved. We would contend that certainly Hansen v. Smith is not applicable to his situation because that's a case involving habeas relief and collateral attack, and this is not a collateral attack, it's a direct attack, as I suppose is Mr. Davis. And we'd also contend the Kaywood's case and Simmons are controlling. Specifically, and this gets to the point of the fact that in October the 27th, 2014, the grand jury met. They presented in open court the indictments, and then there was a trial November 17th of 2014, and the order was finally entered January 13th, 2015, that records the fact that Mr. Epps and Mr. Davis were indicted and that the indictments were presented in open court. The holding in Simmons, which essentially takes its finding from Kaywood's case, is that no man can be tried for a felony in the courts of this Commonwealth except upon an indictment of a grand jury, and the indictment must be presented in open court and the fact recorded. Until this is done, the accused is not indicted. So the idea that this is a Jefferson or Rollins type of issue where the court can say, you know, even possibly 3 years after the fact, as was the case in Jefferson, we're finally going to put this on the books. That doesn't cure this issue because of the specific holding in Simmons, which is still good law, that requires that recording to be done before whatever has been handed down by the grand jury is considered to be an indictment. And so that's why, even though we had what was ostensibly a trial, there was not, if it's not jurisdiction, I suppose it's authority to exercise that subject matter jurisdiction pursuant to the criminal procedure statutes that are within the Code of Virginia. And so that's how, at least in the case of Mr. Epps, there is error because he was tried without a knowing, voluntary, intelligent waiver of indictment, and he was tried without there being, according to the precedent in Simmons, any indictment whatsoever. Now, certainly, Mr. Epps also, in his case, has a sufficiency of the evidence assignment, and I think that it's important to note the Attorney General's brief indicates, to the extent that Mr. Epps is challenging his misdemeanor conviction, he's not. The only case that was appealed is the abduction. We don't believe that any indictment is necessary in a misdemeanor case, and that is one reason why we chose only to appeal the one case. The other reason that choice was made was essentially out of sort of an abundance of caution to say there can't be two convictions for the assault and battery and the abduction if the abduction is merely incidental to the assault and battery. So the assault and battery, it's done, it's over, it's stuck. This court can't do anything about it if for some reason it found that the assault and battery was the one that should go away. That said, we would suggest what is controlling there is the Brown case, that our argument is the evidence read in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, which is what is necessary in this stage of the appeal, and giving it all inferences therein, that there is no objection other than what is necessary for the assault and battery, that, for instance, the blocking of one door in the home and the kitchen that did not accompany with it any assault did not rise to the level of abduction.
Let me ask you this, counsel. How did that not rise to the level of abduction when it restrains her from passing through?
We would suggest that it doesn't, because this is a home that, if I recall the record correctly, has three different exits. One of them may have been blocked by, I think, a rocking horse or some type of toy. And we would contend that given the abundance of other ways to exit the home, the abduction did not lie just by him blocking one of those exits, particularly it being one that she followed him to, we would argue. Certainly, I think that lays out the issues in each of these cases. If there are no other questions, then certainly I will yield the remainder of my time that was not saved for rebuttal.
Thank you. Ms. Martin?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Kathleen Martin for the Commonwealth. We would ask that both of these cases be affirmed because, with regard to the indictment issue, there was no problem with the indictment, and the Circuit Court had jurisdiction to try both of these cases. With regard to the Davis case, because the Court had jurisdiction, Mr. Davis entered a conditional guilty plea, and under 19.2254, when you enter a conditional guilty plea, you can only appeal an adverse determination of a specified pretrial motion. This was not a pretrial motion in terms of challenging the indictment. It came after the verdict had been rendered, and so certainly if the court had jurisdiction, which we submit that it did, this is not something that can be handled through a conditional guilty plea. So for that reason, Mr. Davis is just out of luck on his claim. And then certainly also under 5A18, because it was not raised at trial, and it's not a good cause or ends of justice kind of exception because the court had jurisdiction, he is barred on that reason as well from raising this on appeal. And then we have 19.2227, which would apply to both cases, that you can't object to an indictment after the verdict unless there's some defect that violates the Constitution. And again, we would submit that there is not that kind of defect in the indictment in this case. So for all of those procedural reasons, the court should not even get to the substantive issue that is raised in these cases. And with regard to the merits of the cases, and this would apply to both of them, that Caywood and Simmons are distinguished because in both of those cases, there was no record at all saying that the indictment had been returned in open court by the grand jury. In Caywood, there was an order listing the various indictments that the grand jury had returned at its April term in the 1820s, and that list did not include Caywood's name. It simply does not appear. And so for that reason, the court held that there was no record that an indictment for Mr. Caywood had been returned. And in Simmons, again, the record didn't show that there had been any kind of indictment returned in open court and recorded. But in this case, we do have a recorded order. Now, it was recorded after the trial, but that is really just a procedural aspect of the case. It doesn't have anything to do with the substance of the indictment. He was indicted on October 27th of 2014, and the order says that the grand jury met, returned these indictments in open court. There's a listing of all the people who were indicted on that day and includes both of these men. And that order did not get entered by the circuit court until January 13th of 2015. But as in the Jefferson case, that doesn't mean that it didn't exist until it got entered. It simply means that when it was entered, it was just a reflection of the judicial act that had already taken place. And the statute 17.1123A that talks about how the orders of daily court proceedings are recorded by the clerk in the order book doesn't really have any sort of timing aspect in that it says, you know, an order that happened on April 6th must be entered on April 6th or April 7th or, you know, whatever. There's nothing in this statute or in any statute that I'm aware of that talks about how the order has to happen right away. And as apparent in many cases, in a sentencing order, it'll say the sentencing date was on January 10th, but the order doesn't get entered until January 22nd, just when it comes before the court and they enter it. But that doesn't mean that something didn't happen on January 10th. And so certainly here, we do have the different facts. We do have a recorded order showing that these indictments were returned by the grand jury in open court, as is required to make it an official act. So the indictment complied with all the requirements in terms of setting forth the offense and code sections and when it happened. The defendant was certainly, in both of these cases, aware of what the charges were. They could prepare their defenses. They were not prejudiced in any way by the fact that this order didn't get entered until after the fact. So for those reasons, we would say that because indictments is a statutory requirement, it can be waived. It's not a jurisdictional requirement in this instance, and the court did have jurisdiction, and so certainly there's no merit to that part of the argument. With regard to Mr. Epps and the sufficiency, we have separate offenses that occurred here at different parts of this house. In the bedroom is where the altercation began, and that is where the assault and battery happened. We have the defendant choking the victim, grabbing her foot, bending her toes, biting her little finger. At that point, he stops his behavior. She gets away from him. She runs to the kitchen. And I believe that her testimony was that he followed her to the kitchen. It's the defendant's testimony that she followed him. But in finding the defendant guilty, the trial court would have accepted the victim's testimony of the events that happened, because according to the defendant, he didn't do anything to her. He didn't tell her she couldn't leave. He didn't do anything. And the trial court simply didn't accept that. So we have the assault occurring in the bedroom. We have the kitchen where he wouldn't let her leave the house. He said, I'm not going to let you leave. He kept her from getting her phone so that she could call anyone for help. That is where the abduction occurred, where he deprived her of her personal liberty of leaving the house. The fact that there were two other doors in this house, one of them was blocked by a toy car that was quite heavy and wasn't, the door wasn't easily opened. The other door, as I recall, was on a different level of the house, like maybe a basement or a lower level. And so there was no real testimony that it would have been easy for her to, you know, get out that door as well. so certainly, in the Brown case, it talks about how the abduction is not supposed to be merely incidental to the other crime. Well, here, because we have these separate offenses that occurred at different parts of the house at different times, it's like the Chapman case, where the malicious wounding was done before the detention occurred. And so, certainly, we have separate offenses. The court did not err in finding the defendant guilty of both of these offenses in the Epps case, and so we would ask that it be affirmed. We'd ask that Davis be affirmed on the indictment issue. I'll be happy to answer any other questions.
Thank you very much. Mr. Smallwood? Mr. Smallwood, as to Epps, and particularly in relation to the statute requiring the challenges to an indictment be made prior to a verdict, do we have to find that the court lacked subject matter jurisdiction in order to agree with your argument?
No, I don't think that you do, and I think that it's because other statutory language requires there be an indictment on a felony trial absent waiver thereof. And so we would suggest that there can't be a trial to reach the verdict that's contemplated in the statute that the court is asking about. And so even if this doesn't rise to the level of subject matter jurisdiction, if it is just authority to exercise jurisdiction, that that still puts this in the position where that statute does not apply. That statute is intended, we'd suggest, for challenges, for instance, to the racial composition of the grand jury, and challenges of that nature, and not to this type of challenge that would suggest that the no trial would be possible. And so, therefore, that's what we would suggest. We also would suggest that, in terms of harmless error analysis, that gets brought up in the brief of the Attorney General, that there is true error here, and that it is not harmless, and that it comes from exactly that, that absent this order, there is simply no way to know the persons who make up the grand jury, and to challenge issues such as the racial composition of the grand jury. So therefore, it's not just a matter of did he know what he was charged with, but a matter of there being a procedural issue, whether the procedure for an indictment has been complied with, but also a more substantive issue in terms of who is it that considered this indictment against him and returned a true bill. You know, certainly we would suggest that the our position in this case, just to be clear, is the Hansen v. Smith, for one of the reasons that I have indicated, I think that I have suggested three different reasons, was wrongly decided, or that it's an apposite, because this is a direct appeal and it is a finding on a collateral attack, a habeas petition. The Caywood and Simmons are controlling in this case. The holding in Simmons requires the presentment to be done in open court and the fact to be recorded, and that until that's done, the accused is not indicted. And it's for that reason we would ask the court to reverse the convictions of both of these men and to return the cases to the Circuit Court for the City of Danville for proceedings that are not inconsistent with what we've argued here today.
All right. Thank you very much.